everyone, and welcome to the Primordial Soup Pot. My name is Aaron.
And I'm Rustin.
Every 2 weeks, Rustin and I get together to discuss topics in the field of ecology, natural history, and evolution. And we are starting off season 3.
Absolutely. So we should be saying welcome back to the Primordial Soup Pot, really.
Welcome back. Yeah, it's been a bit of a hiatus.
It has. You know, sometimes you just need a little bit of a break, just to miss each other a little bit. So that's what we figured the break between seasons really would be, I guess.
That and editing. I hate
yeah, editing. Oh, editing.
It's the worst part of all this.
It's like, honestly, I could record podcasts all day, talking to you about whatever, you know, cool new topic I found. Could do that all day long. Even researching. Researching's not that bad. But editing, ugh. It's just monotonous.
Weighs down on your soul.
It really is. It is soul-crushing. I digress. We're really excited to start our third season. We've been doing this for a couple years, and we didn't really have any particular topic in mind for this episode. With that in mind, Aaron, you want to kick this show off?
Anything goes for this one. So I'll kind of walk you through a little scenario, as I like to do. You are in Scotland. You stroll through the highlands, bound in your plaid kilt, castles all around you, faint sounds of bagpipes in the distance, and you breathe in the refreshing air and smell the haggis. Mel Gibson cries out for freedom over the horizon. Sean Connery sips his dry martini. And a one-eyed drunk is lobbing explosives in the Loch Ness.
Okay.
And you look around, you see some of Scotland's unique wildlife, like red deer, Highland cattle, sound familiar, the wallabies.
Hey.
I literally put pause for effect in my script there. Yeah, wallabies. There's wallabies in Scotland.
What?
Yep. So we're kicking off season 3 with one of my favorite topics, a little bit of history, an island, and an invasive species.
It's like God wrote this bit for our show just so you could talk about it.
Yeah.
It has everything you love to talk about on this show.
As soon as I learned about it, I'm like, all right, this is the perfect little topic to kick things off.
All right, so hit me with it.
All right, so first off, the history. The wallabies of Scotland are actually confined to a specific island in the middle of Loch Lomond, known as Inchkenaken. Inchkenaken. I will call it Wallaby Island because I don't really know how to pronounce this one. I mean, it looks like Inchkenaken, but I can't imagine it's pronounced that simply.
Probably not.
So similar to the bison of Catalina Island, see the first episode of season 2, these wallabies were just released onto the island. And unlike the bison, this was not for any real purpose other than they were cool. Someone just thought they were cool and wanted to put them there.
Okay, so kind of like the starlings here in North America?
That at least, like, it was something about Shakespeare, right?
The specific reason was that this theater enthusiast wanted to see all the birds of Shakespeare in North America. And so they released starlings in Central Park or in New York City, I think it was, because there was some reference to them in a Shakespearean play. But really, there's no difference between that and, I don't know, it's probably going to be cool.
Yeah, I guess it's not too far off. We do know who these came from. They originated from Fiona Gore, the Countess of Arran. And Fiona was born into a noble family in 1918 and grew up in a state along Lake Lomond. She was an interesting figure. I could only find one news article on her, really. Not a ton of information, but she spent most of her childhood swimming and exploring the woods. You know, definitely an outdoorsy kid. Actually became a powerboat racer and set a record in 1980 for the fastest woman on water at age 62. Live life to the fullest.
Absolutely.
The daughter of a clan chief and champion golfer. She married a count. She regularly raced boats and cars, like I said, joined the Ministry of Information during World War II, and championed for homosexual rights and badger conservation.
Do those two things usually go together?
When it comes to her, it did. She happened to really like badgers.
Because the way you said that really sounds like they do. Is like championing homosexuality and badger conservation are just almost like paired causes.
You know, maybe Parliament was tied up. they needed one vote to legalize gay marriage, and then you just had an environmentalist guy come on. It's like, fine, we'll put on the Badger Rider on this one.
Maybe he just had
that's how it passed.
Maybe he just had family in Wisconsin.
Is that Badgers?
Yeah, University of Wisconsin is the Badgers, Aaron.
I did not know that.
Oh, okay. Hopefully somebody does.
I'll just chuckle, and then we'll pretend that I got it. Cut that bit. Yeah, that's right. maybe I'll leave it in. She liked Badgers. Apparently, she had several that lived under her porch, with her favorite being named Rosie, whom she would travel around with. She liked animals. Besides badgers, she kept many unique different ones, including llamas, alpacas, and wallabies. In Loch Lomond, her favorite island was actually the Wallaby Island, and in Gaelic, it actually translates to their clan's name.
Okay.
So, at some point in the 40s, a couple of wallabies were turned loose onto the island, and boom, they have a small population. Not too much else history-wise. And been going strong there ever since. Now we'll shift back to the science part of things. The wallabies found here are redneck wallabies. Scientific name is Notomacropus rufogrisius, which roughly translates to striped big feet red gray. Pretty obvious scientific name. Just tells it as it is.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I didn't even mention it. For those who don't know, wallabies are just mini kangaroos.
Right. Right, you forgot to mention
yeah,
that.
I skipped over that. Yeah, for all intents and purposes, take a kangaroo, scale it down. Wallabies, these ones, get about 30 to 40 pounds, and they get about 3 feet or 90 centimeters long. So, you know, they stand a couple feet high.
If you got to bring them on a plane, you put the kangaroo in your check bag, and you put the wallaby in your carry-on.
Yes, that's a perfect way to describe it. They're portable kangaroos.
Exactly.
Of course, they are also native to Australia, as most marsupials are. And put a pin in that, because that comes back later.
I'm sure it does.
Yeah, wallabies are adorable. I mean, look up some photos. They're fun little guys. It's understandable why someone would want to release them in an island. I mean, I'm sure she had no idea. Could potentially do ecological damage.
Oh, sure.
Her heart was in the right place. I mean, she really liked badger rights.
But apparently not wallaby rights. That wasn't a thing.
She liked the wallabies enough to give them their own island.
So why didn't she give this island to the badgers?
Badgers already had, like, they had the run of it. They had their own islands. There's quite a few islands in this loch.
Hmm.
Or maybe she just wanted badgers to belong in all of Scotland, and wallabies could just get this one island, because it was her favorite.
Oh, okay, so she was just containing all the wallabies in one place, really.
I don't know what the thought was behind it, but we know they were put there at one point. I don't think they were just dumped there out of neglect. I think the intent was, I like wallabies. I want wallabies to be here. Anyways, wallabies are marsupials, of course. So marsupials are mammals that have pouches. They carry their young in pouches. Again, think mini kangaroos. They're native to the scrublands and coasts of eastern Australia, where they live primarily solitary, but occasionally gathering in groups, and they feed on grasses, roots, and leaves. So these wallabies are actually not found in super arid or tropical environments. Most people tend to associate the two with Australia, but they're actually found in the temperate southern regions. So they've adapted to Scotland fairly well.
Oh, okay. Good for them.
The Wallaby Island is small. It's about 40 acres by most estimates I found. I found several conflicting sources on this, actually. Anywhere from 30 to 100 acres. Most of them said about 40. Regardless, it's a small island. It is mostly forest, the only man-made structures being a small dock, boathouse, and a cabin, which was all constructed for Countess Fiona, and now they're pretty much all falling apart. No one lives on the island now. The only way to get to the island is by boat, and for most people, this involves just renting a kayak from a nearby town. It's not that far to get there. You can paddle across. And it's a popular, albeit not super well-known, camping site. So in Scotland, wilderness camping is fully legal. So you can more or less just throw down anywhere in the woods. In other countries, there's certain restricted areas you can't go to. But in Scotland, pretty much everything out there is fair game. I mean, you still got to get to it on your own. It might not be the most accessible, but you can get to it. you should be able to just camp there.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
And people seem to respect the site for the most part and appreciate the bizarre wildlife. Because you have to work to get to it. It's not like there's a bus or like a boat tour that'll take you there. So I think if you're willing to put in the work to get to it, you're not going to just litter, you know, throw your trash everywhere. At least that's what I like to think. So yeah, people seem to respect it. And I read an article from the BBC about a reporter having a wonderful solo camping trip on the island. So if any of you listeners happen to be in Europe, consider this. Seems quite nice.
Plus there are wallabies.
There are wallabies. That ain't that fascinating. You don't see that everywhere.
No, no. And considering that from what we've been seeing from the statistics, a decent portion of our listeners are in Belgium, it's just across the channel.
I think it shifted quite a bit.
Oh, it did?
My thought is that we just had some diehard Belgium listeners, and then as we actually grew, they kept listening, but they were outpaced. Or, you know what, it very well could have been a family of five that just all listened to us. And that was enough to tip the metrics.
The way analytics skew when you're a small podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, as far as we know, we still have a bunch of listeners at the bottom of that one reservoir in Kansas, so...
Yes, yes, that is still the number one. Because if you have any sort of VPN or if it can't pin it down, right in the middle of, I believe, the Cheney Reservoir in Kansas.
Yep, which is right in the middle of the lower 48.
Yeah. You know what? Maybe there's a ton of them right there. Who knows? Little boat city out there.
Just a whole bunch of bass at the bottom of the reservoir that are tuning in.
Ah, the largemouth love this one. All right, so now I'll transition to the wallabies themselves, what impacts they've had on the small 40-some acre island. I only found one scientific article pertaining to this specific wallaby island, and it didn't reveal a ton. It described how they adapted fairly well to the island. The island is a mixture of oaks, blueberry, grasses, and moss, and the wallabies seem to adjust to this just fine. They can feed on a variety of plant matter. On the island, there are no predators to feed on them, and the location has wet but fairly mild winters, so they manage just fine. It's not like they were ever, you know, under severe amounts of snowfall. It's a very wet and cool winter, but not a snowy one. In terms of the effect on the ecosystem, this seems minimal as well, but this is just one paper to go off of. They share habitat with the red deer. The deer populations have not shown any decline. And another thing is the red deer are known to freely travel between the islands. They can easily swim between them all. And The red deer are still on Wallaby Island. So if they were bothered by the wallabies, they probably wouldn't be there. They'd probably just leave.
And the wallabies can't swim.
So the wallabies are capable of swimming, but they have not been documented to do so, at least in any peer-reviewed literature that I've found. I read in a news report that someone said that when the lock freezes over, they can skip across islands, but I'm not even certain if the lock freezes over. I think that's a very rare event, actually.
Okay, so like most influencers, we think they can swim, but when they get near the coast, there's no actual evidence of them swimming.
Yeah, more or less.
Got it.
Like I said, there's not a ton of like proper peer-reviewed stuff on them. Just this one paper pertaining directly to the island. So at least with the red deer, you know, it doesn't seem to be a big deal. The island is home, however, to the capercaillie. Capercaillie. It's a type of grouse, which is a bird that kind of resembles a large black pigeon. The capercaillie is endangered and does feed on some of the same berries as the wallabies, being the blueberries that I mentioned. However, they seem to prefer eating other species of plants like heather. The capercaillie will also eat sedge and insects and even pine needles in the winter. There's no definitive evidence of whether or not the wallabies are competing with the capercaillie, although they do share some overlap in diet. The wallabies are just much more adaptable. The capercaillie seem to be more specific, changing their diet depending on the time of the year or their life stage. They feed on insects more when they're young, and the adults will feed primarily more on plant matter.
Got it.
Another thing is the capercaillie can fly. Despite spending a lot of time on the ground, they're still capable of it, so I imagine they could also relocate to another island if the wallabies were a huge problem.
Do you know why the capercaillies are endangered?
Why they're endangered? usually the answer is habitat loss.
Right.
Well, they are large, so they're probably hunted at one point. And even though they can fly, they are a very terrestrial associated bird. So they can fly, but they're not the best at it. They do spend a lot of time closer to the ground. So that makes them a lot more prone to predators like house cats.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a significant reason behind their decline, but generally with most birds that don't fly very well, those are the factors that do them in.
Got it. Okay.
In terms of wallabies' life on this island specifically, that is about it. But I wanted to shift gears and discuss why the situation is weird. And it's because these are marsupials. So marsupials, they rear their young in a pouch. Kangaroos, koalas, possums, wombats, etc. And marsupials usually get their ass kicked. So if you know about mammals, marsupials are one of three groups of mammals. They're placental mammals, which is basically every mammal. Cats, dogs, humans, rats, bats, whales, horses, cows, pigs, etc. And their young develop with a placenta and give birth to a more or less developed child. In some, they still might come out pink and, you know, a little squishy.
Emphasis on more or less. Babies are not fully developed humans. Let's get that right out of the way.
So with some animals, like humans, yes, they're not fully developed.
Babies are still human larvae. Let's be honest. They're adorable, but they're still human larvae.
Yeah, they're not fully formed yet. I mean, with humans, they can only get so big before they can't fit through the hip anymore. So that's why they got to get shot out.
Correct.
But other animals, like a giraffe, can stand within a couple hours. And then any aquatic mammal, like a whale or dolphin, they got to be able to start swimming.
Right away.
So that's why I say more or less developed. But comparatively, they are so much more developed to the other two. The marsupials, the pouch mammals, most of their young come out like the size of a jelly bean. So like a red kangaroo, its baby can fit in your hand. I mean, you compare that to the size of the adult, that is a massive difference. They don't develop much inside the mother, but they develop in the pouch. And then the other group are the egg-laying monotremes, the echidnas and the platypus. And of course, they're eggs, so they don't develop inside at all. The last two groups are really only found in Australia. And that's because Australia is a big island. These mammals were there when it became isolated. And that's why they took over, because that's what was there. That's what established when Australia broke off and became its own thing. There are very few marsupials living on any other continent. There are a few possums in the Americas. Marsupials usually get outcompeted by placental mammals every single time. There are dozens of species of placental mammals invasive to Australia, but there are so very few marsupials invasive to other parts of the world. Yeah, so if you take a look at it, Australia kind of had their own version of everything that we have, like in the Americas. So they have essentially their own mice, their own moles, they have their own dogs. Of course, these are all marsupials, but convergent evolution, they fill out the same niches. And when you introduce placental mammals to Australia, they outcompete the marsupials almost every time.
Right. So Australia is basically an alternate reality where placentas don't exist.
Well, no. Anything aquatic or aerial. So bats, they do have many native bat species. And of course, seals, whales, dolphins, all of that. But in terms of the ground, no. Or this is a reason why marsupials are traditionally seen as antiquities or primitive mammals. Some of the main critiques include that they have less developed brains than placental mammals. They're typically less social. They give birth to extremely underdeveloped and vulnerable young that must live in a pouch to continue growing. And because of that, they have lower reproductive rates. They can't have a lot of young at one time. They can only have a few, only what they can carry with them at all times. So even though they don't carry their young as long as a placental mammal inside their body, they still have to carry them in a pouch where they are much more vulnerable. Like I said, kangaroos give birth to the baby the size of a bean. Animals like whales or giraffes have babies that can stand or move within a couple hours. So I read a paper on the introduction of non-native marsupials. So basically, any single circumstance where a marsupial became an invasive species. And in almost every scenario, it was either a successful introduction in a part of Australia where they weren't native to, and it was just other marsupials. It was an island in the Pacific Ocean, or an area completely depleted with predators. And every time that they became an established species in an area they weren't native to, it was usually like they used to be native here at one point, we successfully reintroduced them, or similar species lived here in Australia, and we brought them over and they kind of filled that niche. In terms of Pacific Islands, there really weren't that many mammals on the islands at all, so they can just kind of take over. There's actually an island where koalas live on that they aren't native to, and it's a threat to some of the other wildlife there because they're taking out the foliage. They have no predators. Or it's an area depleted with predators altogether. So there is quite a few marsupials found in New Zealand now, a couple possums there. New Zealand never really had terrestrial predators. They didn't have any mammals over there, actually. So yeah, it's easy for them to establish. But it's also super easy for a rat or a cat to do it. In fact, they probably do it much better. The red-necked wallaby is one of the few exceptions to this because it actually has a few invasive populations spread across Britain, New Zealand, Germany, and the Isle of Man, which is kind of its own thing north of the British Isles.
Sorry, you said this species is called the red-necked wallaby?
The red-necked wallaby, yeah.
So it's like a normal wallaby that loves country music and drives a truck?
There's a lot of them down south. And then they congregate in trailer parks and watch NASCAR. Right.
They're very upset about Kris Kristofferson. Rest in peace.
They have a habit of, if you put any wooden fence, just four of them will congregate in front of it and just stand there.
And just with a cooler and just drink beer.
Yep. So, like I said, redneck wallabies, quite a few invasive populations spread across mainly Europe, but also New Zealand. But in almost all of these cases, there's not really any predators. New Zealand, like I mentioned, has no native ground predators. What they do have now are things like cats. Wallabies bigger than a cat. The other areas have historically low amounts. So the island in Scotland does not have any predators. Simply because there's just not enough prey animals to sustain them. I mean, something like a fox could easily swim out the island if it really wanted to, but there's just not a lot of food there. I mean, it's a small island, so it's not terribly worth the effort.
More of a vacation area than a permanent home for them.
The other invasive populations, like I mentioned, in Britain, Germany, or Isle of Man, all these areas have historically low amounts of large predators. That's kind of a trend you see across most of Europe.
Right.
So they still have things like foxes and predatory cats, but, you know, that's about it. Things like wolves, they used to be incredibly widespread across all of Europe, and they're very diminished now. So the wallabies don't really seem to thrive in the presence of any sort of predator, but it just so happens the areas they're in don't really have any.
Okay, so they got lucky.
They kind of did get lucky. It's interesting to note how these wallabies are still going in Scotland. They're most likely horribly inbred. I mean, they're all descending from four individuals.
Yeah. When you brought this topic up, I started thinking about the wolves in Isle Royale. Basically, it's a case study in how detrimental inbreeding can be to a population. It's a clear example of what they call an inbreeding depression, where if you start inbreeding a population, all those rare genetic defects start, you know, really coming out in full force in a population over time, and it really diminishes really the fitness of the population as a whole. And that's kind of what's happening with the wolves on Isle Royale, is they're starting to have a lot more birth defects and things like that scientists have observed. That kind of thing happening with the wallabies in Scotland?
There's not been any research on that to my knowledge. However, when I discussed Catalina Island, there was a paper where they talked about how the bison on that island were more likely to have joint issues. They're just deformities overall. They were smaller, more malnourished. Part of that could be the environment, but another part is inbreeding.
Sure.
So technically, these are the inbred redneck wallabies. Quite a great title.
Yeah.
Sometimes the jokes write themselves.
They really do. I could say there's so many things I could say about that, all of which we'd have to edit out, so I'm not going to say them at all.
So, like I said, the wallabies seem to be capable of swimming to other nearby islands. I have yet to see any, like, definitive documentation of them doing so. They have not been found in any other island besides the Wallaby Island, even though there are plenty nearby. I don't think they pose a huge threat to Scotland's ecosystems, especially since they seem to be contained, but not everyone thinks so. In 2020, the islands were purchased, and the new owners wished to relocate the wallabies. You know, at least they weren't going to hunt them all down, but many people were not happy with this. One man even said doing this would be, quote, akin to translocating Nessie.
Whoa. Okay.
So, like I said, the wallabies have a cult following. They're popular. I mean, people go out just to see them. The new owners have a plan to maintain its status, but as a nature reserve, and remove all non-native flora and fauna. Of course, that includes the wallabies. There is significant pushback to this. As of now, the wallabies are still roaming the island, but there's been a lot of petitions, a lot of angry people that want the wallabies to stay there. Personally, I say you give it the Assateague approach. What we have in Maryland, Wild Pony Island.
Sure.
Maintain the population so as minimal disturbance. Utilize tourism money to protect the native species, like that grouse that I mentioned earlier. Do wallaby boat tours. There are native, or there are local towns that you can rent boats from. Just do that there. You go, you show up, you know, you get on a nice little dinghy, ride around the island, and just spot a wallaby. It'd be cool. It's a great outing, and even if you don't see one, it's a nice boat tour, you know, maybe bringing a lunch out on it.
Sure. I would actually say that would work better than Assateague, because there aren't any roads on that island, so you aren't going to deal with a huge backup whenever somebody sees a wallaby.
Absolutely, yes. There are no roads on the island. You cannot drive to it at all. We were there one time, and I remember sitting in traffic for about 15 minutes, because they have an escort for all the ponies, because they're wild. So when the pony's walking across, you know, someone's got to hold up a stop sign.
Even when there isn't a pony actually crossing the road, somebody will see a pony and just throw on the brakes right away. And all of a sudden that creates a 10 to 15 minute backup, especially if it's a weekend during the summer when everyone's trying to get to Assateague. Oh, it's a mess.
So, like I said, do wallaby boat tours around the island, and you can call or sell any excess wallabies to prevent them from spreading, which they do at Assateague.
Sure.
Do sell off some of the ponies.
Sure.
As of now, the actual impacts of the wallabies is not known. The only paper I read on their diet was focusing more on parasitic loads on them, which they have parasites, I guess was the takeaway. Yeah, it didn't really focus on competition. In other European environments, it was determined that they do have dietary overlaps with native species, like rabbits, that one paper found. But long-term impacts have not been studied. And I mean, they've only really been there since the 40s, which overall is fairly recent.
Yeah, that's not that long.
Until then, it's a neat little animal thrown on an island story that I love and is very dear to me. And an interesting case of marsupials invading placental mammal territory when so often is the other way around.
Cool. That is the Aaron Johnson podcast bread and butter right there.
Yes, as soon as I saw it, I'm like, I gotta cover this.
We've done, at least two episodes on islands in the history of this podcast?
We've mentioned islands many times, if we've only done proper episodes on islands, only a few. But, we talk about islands so much.
Yeah. Don't get me wrong, I totally get it. They serve as this microcosm of a larger ecosystem where only certain elements get thrown in, and we just kind of get to sit back and see what the hell happens without any interference from the outside world. Mm-hmm. So they're fascinating to study. So I totally get it, but it's just funny that you kind of obsess about them.
Oh, they're cool. I mean, if you think about ecology, pretty much any other field of science, you can do an experiment in the lab. Like biochemistry, you're not leaving the lab. Genetics, you're not leaving the lab.
Sure.
Ecology, you can't really just create an environment to study. And you can't just study a whole continent. I can't just study all of North America at once. But an island is perfect because it's small, it's manageable, And whenever a change happens, you can usually see it happening in real time.
That's the thing about a lot of ecology studies, or even just like studies on a natural environment that aren't even focused on animals per se. There's no way you can control all the variables, right? There's just so many things going on. It's a completely uncontrolled environment. So the best you could do is kind of get a snapshot of what's going on. You can't create this very regimented, controlled study the way you would in a lab. Just a very, very different animal altogether.
Yes, exactly. It's its own thing. You know, hard to work around. But that's why I love islands. They're perfect.
And to your point, the islands kind of give you a little bit of control that you didn't previously have. You know, or they eliminate some of those other confounding variables that you would have normally had to deal with in a study.
Yeah, so you can at least know what's coming in and out. I mean, that's the biggest thing, is isolating something. Whenever you're doing a study, you want controls. Like, you don't want the temperature, the light, basic stuff like that. You don't want that to just change randomly. And unfortunately, when you go outside, you have very, very little control. Island is as good as it gets.
Yes, just ask anybody who goes camping in the middle of nowhere in Scotland how much they can actually control about their trip.
Anyways, that's my piece. What do you got for me, Rustin?
Given that it's our first episode of our third season, and that we didn't have any specific topic set or theme set for this episode, I was thinking that I should start with something that is truly eye-catching. What would be the most clickbaity thing that I could talk about? Just, you know, for the views here. Then I thought, well, what is more eye-catching than just like a giant party, right?
Oh, so I was thinking YouTube, the thumbnail where it's like top 10 snakes you don't want to run into.
Oh, and yeah.
It's an AI-generated photo of a 40-foot rattlesnake, something like that.
Yeah, and there's a big red arrow pointing at something random in the thumbnail.
It's a big red arrow. It's not even pointing at anything. Or it's, these are the five dinosaurs paleontologists are afraid to study.
Right. Not quite something on that level, because we're trying to base this in fact here. What if that party featured a really well-known and scary animal? And what if that animal was on some kind of drug that just makes people go crazy? If you've been following the headlines generated by ecological studies in the last few months, you probably know where I'm going with this one. Do you know where I'm going with this one yet?
I think so.
Because there's a story which pretty much checks all these boxes. And that story would be the cocaine sharks of Brazil.
Okay, I was not thinking that. I was thinking about people licking toads, but that wasn't a new thing. That was like people have been doing that for a while.
No. So this is a story that came out just within the last few months. Obviously, the phenomenon itself has been in development for decades now, but it's really only gained some traction within the last year or so, and only gained attention after the studies were published and they created news headlines all over the internet over the summer. So, first place for me to start with this study, I think, is with the prevalence of cocaine in the country of Brazil. That's like your major background information here. So Brazil is actually not the top producer of cocaine. It's not really a top producer of cocaine at all. But it does border three huge producers, which are Bolivia, Peru, and Colombia.
So you're telling me it's just the top exporter of cocaine?
Bingo. Fun fact, though, Colombia alone grows almost twice as many coca plants as Bolivia and Peru combined. A lot of this activity is happening in Colombia. Because Brazil borders these countries, and those borders are very long and very difficult to police because of the terrain and the dense rainforest in those areas, it is very easy to move illegal items, in this case cocaine, into Brazil from neighboring countries. And from there, the drug makes its way to major ports along Brazil's Atlantic coast, and then from there, all over the world, really, primarily to Africa, Europe, and Asia. Most of the cocaine exporting that goes to North America happens directly from Colombia. So Brazil's not really involved in exporting cocaine to North America and the United States, based on the information that we have.
I mean, if they were, would they say it?
Right, that's like, what I'm saying.
Where do they get that from? Like,
right, that's kind of what I'm saying.
We talked to one of the drug kingpins, and he said, nah, not you guys. That's someone else.
Yeah. Right, and then we didn't arrest him.
Yeah, try knocking next door, you know?
Exactly.
Colombians, am I right?
Right, we talked to him, and then we got him to roll on the super drug kingpin that's above him. Like,
yeah.
No. Anyway, Brazil occupies this unique position as a very large transshipment country for cocaine making its way to these three separate continents. So While small amounts of cocaine are actually produced in Brazil relative to its South American neighbors, huge amounts of it flow through the country on their way to other markets. And demand for cocaine, much as we might try to change that, is only increasing, right? Populations are growing. There are more and more people. There are more and more people who happen to discover cocaine and think, hey, it's just the best thing ever. And really, the main place to get it is from South America. So, because cocaine is so prevalent, and as you can imagine with any highly prevalent chemical, it inevitably winds up in rivers and streams, particularly if that chemical is soluble in water. And when you have as much cocaine moving through your country as Brazil does, it inevitably winds up in the rivers, streams, and bays of Brazil in detectable concentrations. There is some speculation as to how the cocaine winds up in the waterways. Some point to drainage from illegal labs which process cocaine. Others point to lost or discarded packages that are thrown in rivers from, you know, smugglers who are close to being caught.
Now, I'll tell you where it comes from. That guy they interviewed saying that Brazil wasn't behind at all. Yeah, as soon as he saw the feds outside his door, he's pouring it all down the drain.
No.
He's like, oh, and that's some other guy. I don't know about that one. It's actually not Brazil, by the way. Did you know it's Colombia, Peru, what was the other one? Bolivia?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's those guys. Those guys. They do way much more than us.
No, what I actually forgot to tell you was that the streams that they tested are all the ones behind Henry Hill's house. So that's actually where all the cocaine is.
Yeah, but skew the metrics a bit.
Yeah, yeah, actually. Anyway, what most scientists believe, however, is that a lot of it is coming from untreated sewage because it contains cocaine from users that's left over after they urinate. And so that's eventually what's winding up in waterways that they detect with these water quality studies. It is fairly common to see detectable concentrations of common medicines like ibuprofen in our waterways, particularly around urban areas. The idea of seeing these kinds of chemicals in our waterways isn't really anything new, but the fact that it's cocaine is eye-catching and a little bit alarming, to say the least. In some areas of Brazil, like Santos Bay, the concentrations of cocaine in the water was similar to the concentration of caffeine.
I'm assuming caffeine is also high.
Let me say that again. There is as much cocaine in some Brazilian waterways as caffeine. What that says about the production and use of those drugs in Brazil is another discussion, but let me remind you that most people drink coffee on an almost daily basis. So if there's as much cocaine as caffeine in the waterways,
it's not the best look.
Right, right. That's kind of what I'm saying here. With such high amounts of cocaine, like any pollutant, it inevitably winds up in the tissues of animals in those ecosystems, which then brings us to the cocaine sharks. The study which prompted all those headlines over the summer was actually a pretty small study in terms of scope, because they only tested the tissues of 13 different sharks. Specifically, those sharks were Brazilian sharp-nosed sharks, which are relatively small. They average only about 52 centimeters in length, which is about a foot and some change for our American listeners, but decided to focus specifically on this one species for a couple different reasons. First, they spend their entire lives in coastal waters, so they seemed most likely to receive a large dose of cocaine from the water supply, right? They figured that most of the cocaine would be distributed along coastal areas as opposed to out in deeper water. And so they thought that if cocaine was detectable in the tissues of any animals, it would be the ones closer to the shore. The sharks really, they're basically like the trust fund kids of the shark world. They spend all their time near the beach, and they are never passing a drug test. The second reason that this species is actually pretty heavily fished, if they wanted to make inferences about how humans could be exposed to cocaine in shark tissues, this would be a good species to examine. In fact, the researchers got their shark tissue samples directly from fishermen, because they'll catch these sharks and then sell them in markets. As for how they actually detected the cocaine, they used liquid chromatography and mass spectrometry to determine whether there were cocaine tissues in the residues of the sharks, and of course, all 13 sharks tested positive for cocaine. Not only did they come back positive, but the concentrations of cocaine in those tissues were 100 times higher than any previously reported in the tissues of other aquatic creatures.
Oh my god.
In my mind, this figure could mean a couple different things. This could be a result of the fact that there haven't been a whole lot of studies targeting cocaine's presence in animal tissues. Or it could just be because there really is just a ton of cocaine in the coastal waters and rivers of Brazil.
All right, did the fishermen have any comment on what it was like catching the sharks? Like, were they fighting for their lives to bring these guys in?
It is currently unknown what effect exposure to cocaine has on the behavior of the sharks.
Oh, okay.
We don't have any information on that. This study, while small in scope, did definitively prove that cocaine is present in animal tissues in the bays of Brazil. It was also one of the first to really specifically target cocaine. There aren't a whole lot of other studies that have done what they did. Really, it was just more of like a pilot study, at least in my mind. That's kind of what it seemed to me, right? Like, it was, we've proven that this particular chemical is present in noticeable amounts. We need to study it more and get more information. That's kind of the way it struck me. But of course, when you read about it in the news, it's all about cocaine sharks, cocaine sharks, cocaine sharks, you know. It's a bit more sensationalist. So in any case, cocaine concentrations of this level are worrisome for the sharks because it could interfere with their ability to form yolk sacs for their egg. Some of the chemical processes that they rely on to produce these yolk sacs are inhibited by cocaine, or at least in theory they are. So it's possible that we could have another DDT type situation on our hands here. But with cocaine instead of pesticides. The results of the study were so extreme that cocaine is actually now considered a pollutant in this part of the world.
What category does that put it in?
You know,
that's his own thing.
Well, I mean, it's a chemical compound that is known to have detrimental effects on wildlife, and it has anthropogenic sources. That pretty much qualifies it to be a pollutant, at least in my mind.
No, but it's not every day that you have a pollutant that's also a recreational drug.
Oh, no, no. Not
the only other thing I think of is nicotine.
You're right about that. Although it is not unheard of for a highly valued substance to have a lot of waste product that then causes an ecological problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, like, think about oil spills. That's a really, really valuable product that we just kind of lost in the ocean, or spilled in the ocean, I guess. It then goes on to cause all kinds of ecological havoc. That is a pollutant, even though it's still a highly valued product. That's kind of how you could look at cocaine in this aspect. It's really, really valuable, but because of how much of it eventually winds up in waterways, it gets listed as and treated as a pollutant.
It's like that one freighter that was full of Legos and then sank, and then like Legos keep washing up on the shore.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Or I remember
highly
a story
valued substance.
Or I remember reading about a study, I guess a case study more than an actual study, but basically there was this freighter that for whatever reason had an entire container full of rubber duckies, and the rubber ducky container got punctured as when the ship sank in the middle of the ocean. I think it was in the Pacific. Basically, because the rubber duckies floated, they wound up just kind of being carried by ocean currents all across the world. And so oceanographers could then use the presence of these rubber duckies to document ocean currents.
That's great. You know, that's making the best out of a bad situation.
So, yeah, just, I guess stuff like that just kind of happens all the time. But again, something like that requires follow-up and future research. And so in this case, that future research is really important from a number of different perspectives. Of course, there are these ecological impacts that I've mentioned, but also public health, right? How are people being impacted by cocaine residues in the tissues of fish that they're eating? Is it enough to actually have an impact on people? Are we seeing any impacts on the general population? That kind of thing. Another interesting avenue here is using tissue samples and testing those tissue samples of aquatic organisms and then geomapping them and using those maps to determine where illegal drug manufacturing is taking place. So basically, if you start testing the samples of all these aquatic organisms throughout, you know, the coastlines, and you know, and you have a noticeably higher concentration of cocaine in one specific area, authorities would obviously be interested in that information, because then they could say, hey, maybe there's something a little bit shady going on there, and we should take a closer look. So it also has law enforcement implications.
It'd just be a great, like, a spinoff show on Fox. Honestly, think of all the police dramas.
Honestly.
Gone. Let me introduce you to the newest member of the DEA task force. I'm Sam Goldberg, marine biologist.
Right. And shark whisperer.
Yeah.
Yeah, honestly, when I was writing the script for this episode, I could have stopped at like two or three different points and just written a pilot for an ABC drama. There's so much you could do with this from an entertainment perspective. That is why I'll certainly be keeping an eye on where this research goes. Who knows? Maybe there could be another update in a future podcast episode that we do. But for now, that's my piece on the cocaine sharks of Brazil.
So I immediately have two questions.
Go ahead.
I'm assuming you said the sharks are being sold to market. I'm guessing they eat them.
Sure.
Do they have to put warnings? Like, is there government warnings? Like, hey, sharks have cocaine in them.
I don't think so. So I'm not sure about that. But I don't think so. Because until recently, nobody had considered that cocaine residues could exist in this kind of degree or at this level. So there wouldn't be any reason to suspect that the fish or sharks you're buying in market would have lots of cocaine in them.
Yeah. You know, it doesn't cross my mind too often.
Right. Like you don't go buy fish at the grocery store and think, I wonder if somebody's tested this for cocaine.
Yeah.
Right. Like you only test for things that you have a reasonable, you know, probable cause to think that they're actually there. And since nobody had thought that cocaine pollution existed on this level before this study, it wouldn't have made sense to put those warnings out.
That being said, if you do go to your local supermarket and ask them, like, the cocaine content of your salmon, I don't think you'll be getting an answer.
No, they definitely won't tell you. In fact, they will look at you like you're crazy, I would think.
They'll probably ask you to leave.
Honestly.
Also, salmon prices, good lord. Just bought some fillets.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah, I saw it at the grocery store this week. Yeah. But anyway, your second question?
Second question. So these are sharks. Sure. Did they say what type of sharks they were?
Yes. I mentioned that earlier. They're Brazilian sharp-nosed sharks.
Do you know how big they are?
Yeah. The ones that they used in this study were, on average, 52 centimeters in length. So a little bit more than a foot. They're relatively small. And they were mainly focusing on juveniles and small adults that inhabit the coastal waters.
I think the next step, obviously I'm not in charge of this research. I imagine they're thinking this. The next step is to compare that to adults and then compare concentrations with age and size. Because when you mentioned sharks, I immediately thought they're higher up on the food chain. Does cocaine accumulate like heavy metals like mercury?
Yes. So that was also a thought that I had. And the thing to mention about this study is that a lot of the individuals they did measure were adults. They were relatively small adults, but still adults. This is a species that likes to stay in coastal areas.
So not a huge species.
No.
So now I want to see with like the top predators, like, I know there's plenty of bull sharks down there, but they can be all over the place.
Right. And with bull sharks, that could be interesting because, of course, bull sharks, as we've talked about, will travel into freshwater areas. So they might be even entering areas of higher cocaine concentrations as they get up into, you know, tidal rivers and things like that.
Yeah, who knows how they're spreading the cocaine residue? Ah, that's really interesting. I actually had not heard of that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing to contemplate, really. And it gave me an excuse to look at all kinds of drug statistics on the UN website.
And now overlap that with their shark statistics. I'm guessing it's not many. Well, now they got to make a new metric for it, apparently.
Yeah, well, I mean, Brazilian sharp-nosed sharks weren't exactly like a really dangerous species. So it's not like the UN would be tracking shark attacks from this particular species. No, the drug statistics were fascinating. Any other questions?
No, that's the two that come to mind. I'm interested to see how this develops.
Me too. I'll definitely keep an eye on it. And if there are really interesting developments, I want to talk about it again.
Good piece. Really liked it.
So, with our themeless episode nearly at its end, do you have an idea for our next theme?
You know, I do. How about a pond episode?
All right.
I actually already have a really good one for this.
I'm sure you do.
Yep.
I'm sure you do. All right. So, stay tuned for our pond episode coming in a couple weeks. And with that decided, do you want to take us out?
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider giving us a follow or review on your podcast app of choice. And if you have a suggestion for a future episode, you can reach us at SoupPotPodcast on Twitter or email us at theprimordialsouppot@gmail.com.
Until next time, I'm Rustin.
And I'm Aaron.
See ya.